Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Wheelock, Judge Hallbrooks, the Honorable Jennifer Frisch presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated, everyone. Good morning. Everything situated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is April 27, 2023. We have three cases on our calendar. The first is A221714, Steele versus Lefevre. Counsel, you're familiar with our procedures. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal at your option. The podium goes up and down, so you can move it to adjust to your height. Please let us know how you would like us to identify you and identify your client and yourself before you begin speaking. These matters are being recorded. No other recordings are permitted. And with that, counsel, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Members of the court, counsel. This is an appeal of the district court's decision to grant summary judgment based on official immunity. The court in Anderson v. Anoka, Hennepin Independent School District states simply the existence of some level of judgment.
Counsel, can we start the clock, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you, Honey.
States Can I just ask you to identify yourself?
Yeah, I apologize. Attorney Jeremy Branningham. I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Donald Steele.
Thank you.
Yes. Again, this case relates to a snowplow accident, and the district court has granted summary judgment against my client for, based on official immunity. In Anderson, the court says simply the existence of some level of judgment or discretion will not necessarily confer immunity. Rather, the court focuses on the nature of the act that is at issue. In the case of In Re Alexandria, accident of February 8, 1994, the Court of Appeals states, for snowplow operators, immunity is granted if the operator applies discretion, and then there's four criteria. While actively plowing, they weigh several factors, including road, weather, traffic conditions, and the act, and they act according to established snow removal policy. And that's kind of the key language there.
Counsel, as I understand your argument, you are claiming that his conduct is the conduct that we're supposed to evaluate to determine whether immunity applies should be condensed to that point in time when he makes a decision whether to stop at the stop sign or go through the stop sign. And I'm not reading the cases as slicing the conduct at issue that thinly. Is there some authority, as opposed to he's out there doing general snowplow operations, and his choice to stop at a stop sign or go through is part of the decision-making process that he's employing while he is undertaking that broad responsibility. Is there some authority that supports the proposition that you're contending allows us to slice the conduct that narrowly?
Yeah, I think the court has, in several cases, talked about looking at the specific act and not just applying general immunity in the Fernow case.
But my question is, what is the specific, how do we define what the specific act is? I'm not talking about general immunity. I'm talking about what was he doing at the time? Was he plowing the roads?
Correct. He was plowing the roads.
And are we looking at his actions in plowing the roads, or are we looking at the snapshot in time when he decides, I'm going through that stop sign?
Mm-hmm. We're looking at that specific act. Well, there's two acts, really. He hears a noise, and that distracts him, and then he runs the stop sign. So there's really two acts. It's in the context of him snow plowing.
So do we look at the broader context, or do we only look at the act? And I'm wondering, what's the authority that tells us that we only look at that snapshot act as opposed to all of his conduct?
Sure. Well, there's several, cases where the court says there is no official immunity, even though in the broader context they're doing something that very well may give them official immunity. As I mentioned before, there's Fernow v. Gould, that's an unpublished decision, but in that case, they looked at that snapshot in time where the snowplow driver was driving and plowing, but he lost control for some unknown reason and went into oncoming traffic. So they looked at that specific act within the broader context of snow plowing. And
are we required to only look at that specific act, or is the district court required to only look at that specific act? I'm not reading the cases that way. That's why I want you to help me with the authority here.
Yeah, I think the best case that I found on this issue, for me anyway, was this Schroeder v. St. Louis County case. And in that case, the court actually looks at the broader context of the road grader. So he was working and he was doing something on the highways. So obviously you could apply official immunity to his conduct, and they did. They actually said him going against traffic was protected behavior or conduct. But whether or not he used his lights was, they pulled that specific act out of the broader context of what he was doing. And they said whether or not he should have been driving using his lights, there was no specific policy reason why he shouldn't have turned his lights on. It wasn't like there was a policy that said, you know, at 6 you have to turn your lights on. The court said that the nature, quality, and complexity of the driver's decision related to whether or not he activated the lights was clearly ministerial. So I think that's kind of the best case for me, because it shows the two examples.
But are you making the argument in this case that this was ministerial as opposed to discretionary?
Yes. That's my argument. Like in Ayers, that's a unpublished decision of the appellate court, Ayers v. Kalal. That's similar, where the snowplow driver ran a stop sign, and then he went in front, you know, he crossed traffic and didn't yield. And the court said that the act of stopping at the stop sign, that was a required act, and failing to yield was a ministerial act. It was similar to this situation. So yeah, that is our position, that it's not discretionary, because it's not like statutory immunity where it's happening at some policy level, but this is an implementation level.
But doesn't the driver have to make a judgment? He hears the thud, he's aware of what's going on around him, he does see the stop sign, and he's cognizant of the speed of the truck, the plow, I should say, and the conditions outside. And doesn't he have to make a judgment, I'm going to slam on the brakes and try to make the stop sign, I'm just going to keep going because I can? Isn't that something that is afforded discretionary function immunity?
Well, you have official immunity because you have officials making policy. And then there's like a protective umbrella based on the policies that are made. And it's my position, or my client's position, that there needs to be some policy. It can't just be, hey, you go out there and do the best you can. But there has to be some policy saying, this is what you should do. So in a lot of these cases, you'll see the snowplow driver actually go through the stop sign because they have their plow is full of snow, and then it's they make a decision it's not safe to stop, and so they weigh all these variables and they say, you know, maybe it is not perfectly safe for me to just not stop, but if I do stop, maybe I'll roll backwards downhill. You know, there's varying factors that they put into this, and they're thinking about what is the safest thing to do. They're still trying to decide what the safest thing to do, but there's a policy, a specific policy that gives them discretion when they're dealing with snow in their plow, and because this is something that happens all the time. He thinks he thought he hit a car.
Well, he didn't know what he hit.
Well, he didn't know what he hit. Right. He speculated that maybe he hit a car. What's the policy when you think you hit a car? I'm saying the city hasn't really, they don't have a policy. So
my understanding is that policies, having worked for a government entity for many, many, many years, that policies establish general guidelines for conduct, but afford those who implement the policies some discretion depending upon the circumstances that are presented to them. And it's pretty much an impossibility to anticipate every single variation of what could happen in the future. And so it's not possible to identify every single circumstance. So what is the authority that would require a policy that is as specific as you're asking the city to provide here?
It's a balancing act, obviously, but there is an over. If you put too much weight on giving them discretion without any policy instruction, then that's not safe. You know, imagine if. So my understanding of what they want is, if you're distracted by a noise, then that gives you permission or discretion to not obey traffic controls. That's kind of like what I hear.
I mean, doesn't the statute regardless of whether the driver hears a noise, doesn't the statute afford plow drivers the discretion to go through a stop sign without stopping?
Yes and no. I think it's the Hockenhale v. Strom case. It says that Minnesota law exempts people and vehicles working on the highway from traffic laws. However, they still remain subject to common law negligence requirements of due care. So that's where official immunity kicks in. Is that
was that an immunity case that you just cited, or was that a negligence case?
I think that was a lot of these cases are both immunity and negligence cases, so it's hard to differentiate that. But I'm just using that case to say that there is a statute that protects these workers from the statutory requirements of obeying the law, but that doesn't make them immune from common law negligence. And that's where you do this analysis with official immunity that we're doing today.
Let me ask you, Mr. Brenningham, you clearly are arguing this was a ministerial act. If we were to disagree with you and conclude this was a discretionary course of events here and decisions that were made by the driver, are you claiming there was any willful or malicious conduct here?
No.
Okay.
I'm not. So if you look at the deposition that I did of the driver in this case, I try to get out of him, what is the policy? Because they never sent me any policy. I don't have anything in writing saying this is our policy. So I'm asking the driver, what is the policy with respect to stop signs? Mm-hmm. And basically,
when you're engaged in plowing.
Exactly, when you're engaged in plowing. And if you look at that, this is page 14, line 24. So are there rules, training about what to do at a stop signs when you're snow plowing? And then he says, yes, it's advisable to stop, but you can roll past them. And then I said, and where do these rules come from? Is this something you can just look up? And he says, that's a good question. Where do they come from? I'm not sure. And then he talks about being trained maybe, 5 years earlier by a guy named Scott. He doesn't know his last name. But the level of clarity about what is and is not appropriate is just, it's not, in my opinion, it's not appropriate. I mean, if this was a private business and they had this kind of standard for this very dangerous type of activity, where you don't have clear guidelines, you don't have real training or manuals or procedures that can be looked up, it's odd. And I think what's happened is they're almost encouraged not to put anything in writing. They're almost encouraged not to have specific policy, because then you could argue, well, they didn't follow the policy. But in this scenario, you can basically say they didn't violate a specific policy because there is no policy. So I'm saying it goes against this idea of general immunity. So if you look at the Anderson case that I cited, the court states, we reject the overbroad generalization that virtually every decision a teacher makes is sufficiently discretionary to warrant official immunity. Now, in that case, if you look at the analysis of the court, somebody was using like a saw, one of the students, and there was like a guardrail that you could use or couldn't use. There was very specific policy that was, and it was the facts at court proved out that there was a very specific policy that they didn't have to use the guardrail, and the court said, well, basically, by attacking the teachers not using this guardrail, you're attacking the policymakers. You're attacking the policy. And that is the example of, like, the protection that is afforded by official immunity. But it's important that there is a factual process that you go through to decide what is the policy. Did they violate the policy? And
Counsel, I see that your time has expired. You will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Gregory Sauter. I'm an assistant city attorney for the city of Minneapolis, and I am here representing the plow driver, Mr. Brent LeFevre, and the city of Minneapolis. Before I get to my prepared remarks, I'd like to address some discussion that happened in oral argument by plaintiff's counsel today. First of all, plaintiff's counsel cited, I counted four different cases that were never argued in his briefing, and since counsel didn't actually have a reply brief, are new to this discussion here today. And I'm talking about the Schroeder case, the Anderson v. Anoka case, the Ayers case, and the Hockenhole case. If counsel had wished those cases to be argued here, defendant, City of Minneapolis, and Mr. LeFevre needed notice of them and would have prepared argument on those cases today. The other argument that is new here today and was not made at summary judgment or made in the appeal brief is the argument that no policy existed for the city of Minneapolis. That argument was not brought up at summary judgment and not brought up in the 6 pages of briefing that appellant submitted to
you. I mean,
today.
To be fair, counsel, in your brief, the lead argument is that there was no violation of a policy.
Yes, Your Honor.
So
that's true.
I think the response to that is there was no policy that was produced.
Your Honor, a plaintiff had an opportunity to have a reply brief and chose not to submit that here today, too. And on top of it, as even at summary judgment, the policy was argued, and there was no argument at summary judgment that no policy existed. That policy came out through the deposition of Brent LeFevre and was established.
How do you address counsel's argument today is that in the absence of a policy, official immunity can never apply? Do you want to address that argument?
My answer is there is a policy here, and then the policy, because the Anderson, or not Anderson, the In Re Alexandria case establishes the policy needs to exist for official immunity to apply.
And what is the policy?
And the
where
policy,
can we find it in the record?
The policy on stop signs, and this is within Mr. LeFevre's deposition, page 15, lines 11 through 15, that he was trained that while plowing, he should try and stop at all stop signs, but he's given to the discretion to plow through them. If he does, he needs to be careful. And that's in the record. Your Honor, respondents request that the court affirm the district court in this matter because immunity is appropriate. Brent LaFavor's failure to see the stop sign until late is directly tied to his plowing and his investigation of the thud that he experienced. He made a choice, as plow drivers are required to do continuously, on the safest and best way to move to both complete the mission of making the streets of Minneapolis safe in a snowstorm or in snowy conditions, and to do the plowing safely. In that case, he had a choice. Could he stop? Should he stop, or should he investigate what happened? And based on his judgment and his over a decade of plowing, he decided not to stop, but he looked back on the sides of back in his mirrors to see if he'd hit anything. He also looked down at his belly plow blade and saw that it hadn't hit anything. At that point, he looked up and he saw that he was at the stop sign. He was slowing, but he was still moving. And he chose to move into he chose not to initiate an emergency stop there for the intersection that was coming up. Based on his training, he's given that discretion to investigate things and to keep on plowing. It's well established that snowplow operators are given immunity when the facts show that they were actively plowing, that they're balancing several factors, including road, weather, and traffic conditions. And in this case, Brent LaFavor was, and they were acting according to an established snow removal policy. He's supposed to use his best judgment while plowing, while continuing, while most efficiently plowing the streets, and then when he comes to a stop sign, generally he should stop, but he can use his judgment to keep on going. When he was at the stop sign here, it was unsafe for him to stop. And that is what the testimony is and the only evidence in this case is. And I remind the court to look at, or I would request the court look at the video and the pictures, because it's clear that even after the plow went through the intersection, there was packed snow and ice on the ground. This plowing was not to bare pavement. The plowing that was being done was the best that could be done in extremely snowy and wintry conditions. And whether one looks at the body camera video, the squad video, or the photos, bare pavement is not visible. In Ray Alexandria, granted immunity when operators weigh various factors and when deciding to plow a highway median and causing whiteout conditions that resulted in an accident. Here, there is no dispute that at all times relevant, LaFavor was actively plowing. Testimony, the body camera video, and the photos show that. There's also no dispute that he was balancing factors. He decided to investigate the thud without stopping. He could have stopped, and we're not saying that he couldn't have. And he decided not to initiate an emergency stop when he saw the stop sign when he was roughly parallel to it. He was acting in accordance with the snow removal policy, specifically about stop signs. And there's no allegation of malice. Counsel stated that here in court today. Discretionary conduct really involves the balancing of many factors. And here we, respondents, ask the court to evaluate the entire plowing situation, the thud, the stop sign, and the decisions made. Because further decisions were made to lessen the extent of the accident. When Mr. LaFavor finally saw the car over the berm in the snow coming towards him, he had a choice. Should I slam on the brakes for an emergency stop? But he chose not to. Instead, he decided to accelerate to hopefully clear the intersection. And the actual dynamics of the crash show that Mr. Steele's car crashed into the back of the plow and not fully into the side or into the front of it, which perhaps could have caused more damage, perhaps less, we don't know. But he was trying to respond to the accident when he saw it approaching him.
Counsel, in your brief, you also ask us to issue a precedential opinion, and it was unclear to me what principle of law that you were seeking clarification on or new ground.
Your Honor, you ask a good question, and it really comes, I was reminding myself of that as I was preparing for the hearing here today. And All of the cases we're arguing about here today about snowplow drivers and going through stop signs or making what would otherwise be ministerial decisions while snowplowing, all of them are non-presidential opinions. When one looks at the Milky v. Miller case, the court granted immunity because failure to see cross traffic was not ministerial and independent from the discretionary acts of the snowplow plowing through the stop sign. That case was discussed in the briefing, and that case came out after the Furneaux v. Gould case that plaintiff has discussed here today. Then there's the Kelly v. Jardy case, which is another case about immunity and snowplow drivers, where the court granted immunity where a snowplow driver went through an intersection through a stop sign and used his discretion, but didn't see the stop sign. And so actually that language is right on point, but it's still yet another unpresidential opinion. The point is there's lots of non-presidential cases here on the topic, but guidance is needed so that we can parse through these issues without only looking at non-presidential opinions.
The district court in its order cited N. Ray Alexandria, which you've talked about, which was a published decision, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was the court's basis, you know, to find here that the obligation to stop did not exist. Is that not a sufficient published decision to cover this particular area?
It's absolutely sufficient, Your Honor, and I wouldn't argue otherwise. The N. Ray, almost all of the law of snowplow operation and immunity comes out of the N. Ray Alexandria case, and we all rely on it.
But going back then to Judge Frisch's question, so what would this syllabus point be, and somehow different from N. Ray Alexandria?
It would help further, Your Honor, it would help further define the law and give both plaintiffs' attorneys and counsel for municipalities and other government entities more direction. That's all, Your Honor.
Okay.
But I'd like to direct the court's attention to the Kelly v. Jardy case because it's pertinent here. And this is a quote from page 4 of the opinion, 2007 Westlaw 1531878. Quote, but the fact that Jardy would not have gone through the intersection without stopping if he had seen Kelly's car does not mean that he acted out of the parameters of his charge duties. It simply means that if Jardy had seen the car while performing his charge duties, his exercise of discretion would have resulted in a different decision. And that's what we find here today, in the sense that had Mr. Lefevre seen the stop sign, or not seen the stop sign, had he seen Mr. Steele's car coming on 35th, he probably would have made a different decision. But that's not what immunity protects. He as a snowplow driver is driving in dangerous conditions with admittedly bad visibility of what's going on. We've got snow berms, we've got snow on the ground, we've got snow kicked up by the snowplow. And he has to make the decisions he has to make. And that's what immunity is there to protect. I would like to address Furneaux v. Gould, the case that counsel and plaintiff argue here. And this case is distinguishable from that case. In that case, the testimony came out that the driver testified that he had no idea why the truck jumped over the center line. It was just a freaky deal. It wasn't the result of an exercise of discretion. And here, Mr. Lefevre's actions were the result of an exercise of discretion. His decision to investigate the thud, his decision to continue when he saw the stop sign, his continue to accelerate when he saw Mr. Steele's vehicle. So therefore, respondents would argue that it's just a fundamentally different circumstance. Respondents also look at the case of the argument made by plaintiff in his appellate brief regarding Thompson v. City of Minneapolis, trying to create a fact issue regarding whether the thud existed. First of all, the response to that is that the Thompson argument is a new argument not made before the district court about any fact issue of the thud. And second of all, the only evidence in the record is that the thud occurred and that Mr. Lefevre investigated it. Not that, and there is nothing to say that the thud did not occur. The city would also like to talk about how it's entitled to statutory immunity. And I'd like to direct the court's attention back to the Furneaux case, because a third part of that case was the statutory immunity argument, and it is why that case was kicked back or sent back to the district court. And in that case, the court determined there was a fact issue about whether or not snow and ice contributed to the accident. And
I mean, do we even need to address that? The city was entitled to a vicarious official immunity, and that wasn't appealed.
Your Honor, it wasn't. You're right.
So we're only dealing with the individual defendant or individual respondent.
Your Honor, I'm dealing with something a little different, and that is one of the arguments respondents made in their brief was even if official immunity is denied, we're entitled to statutory immunity. And the fact that the district court did not address statutory immunity doesn't mean this court can't address the statutory immunity.
I understand that we can. I just wonder why we would do that since the city was dismissed on grounds that aren't appealed.
Your Honor, there's no need to, if there is no need to address the issue unless this court grants the appeal on the official immunity argument. But directing the courts back to the Furneaux v. Gould case, this is a quote from the case: courts in other cases have similarly found that government entities be protected by snow and ice immunity where the snow and ice was merely a factor in the accident. In other words, respondent is arguing that snow and ice was a factor in this accident. It's obvious from the photos, it's obvious from the video, and if it was, then we're entitled to statutory immunity on 466.03 subdivision 4 and also on the policy immunity. I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you,
and
counsel.
I thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much. Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
I do. Thank you, Your Honor. First, with respect to the cases that he said are now being presented that had not been included in the brief. Those are all cases that were in his brief, if you look through a summary of his cases. As far as the no policy argument, that was made at the district court level. I mean, one of my sections, if you look at my response or my reply, memorandum of law, was plaintiff fails to cite to a policy that Lefevre violated.
Why is it that there has to be let me reframe the question. Is there some authority that stands for the proposition that a policy must be titled policy and it can't just be, we're going to train you to discharge your discretionary functions in a certain way and that's how we do it here at the city or at another government entity? Why isn't that a sufficient policy?
Yeah, well, like in the case, I think it was, the Anderson v. Anoka case, I don't think there was a written policy. I think the court just sort of looked at the facts and came to the conclusion that there was a very clear policy about not using this safety guard. So, no, I'm not saying you have to have a written policy. I'm just saying you have to have a clear policy. And the court went into great length about how there was a lot of evidence that there was a policy, and it was undisputed. And that's key, too. In that case, both sides agreed that there was actually a policy in effect on that issue. The counsel today said that this driver was balancing all these things and that he made a decision to not stop. But that's not true. If you look at the transcript of his testimony, I said to him, if you would have seen the stop sign, would you have stopped? And he said, yes. And then I said, what about the fact that it was slippery? Would that have make you more inclined or less inclined to stop? And then he said, well, I would have been more inclined to stop. And then I said, well, what about the weather, like the visibility issues? Would that make you more or less inclined to stop? And he said, that would actually make me more inclined to stop. So, I mean, this is like a mistake. This is not like he's weighing things and then coming up with this, you know, plan to go through this stop sign, and he knows there's risk, but he's balancing those with other risks. It's not that kind of case, you know.
But your questions really presume nothing happened before, you know, the intersection, where we do have this noise, you know, that he was responding to.
Right, and that's the crux of it. Is that noise sufficient justification then to just go through the stop sign? And it's my position is not. Because if it is, you know, imagine how many noises you hear when you're snow plowing. I mean, counsel in his own brief says, you know, this is a noisy business. It is a noisy business. Imagine thousands of noises. Is every noise justification for going through the stop sign? Does it have to happen a block before, 10 feet before, 5 feet before? How loud is the noise? Do you have to show what caused the noise? I mean, it's like there's no standard if you apply this standard. I mean, city bus drivers, they're employees of the city. Can they use noise as a justification for going through a stoplight? And you'd say no, because plows are different because they're pushing snow. That's the point. They're pushing snow. That's a purpose. There's a reason why he doesn't stop when he's pushing snow and he weighs things and he says it's safer not to stop. You don't have that here. There's no connection between the act and the purpose of allowing them to go through the stop sign. So if you allow someone to go through a stop sign in this situation, why wouldn't you allow the bus driver to go through the stop sign when he's distracted by, or she's distracted by noise? It's just, it's not a good law to establish that as a precedence. And as far as this, you know, I just want to quickly address the fact issue. There's a lot of facts in dispute. I have not waived facts. This is a negligence case. They cite some case in their material, this Thiel case, where there was no dispute about the facts. It was a statute of limitations. Date of service wasn't in dispute. And so the court said, well, you can't now question or bring up a dispute about this, the statute of limitations issue, because you've already conceded to that. We haven't conceded to the facts about what happened in this accident. Negligence cases are fact-based, and they're not appropriate for summary judgment.
But, Mr. Brandingham, you're out of time, but just in response to that, I mean, the district court made what I interpret as a factual finding that this thud occurred. And you have not argued in your material that was clearly erroneous. And the record seems to support the fact that this thought occurred. So I do think it's...
There's no transcript of the arguments that were made at the district court level.
No, I'm talking about right now. You have not in your brief asserted that was a clearly erroneous factual finding.
I've asserted the fact that we factually don't know what happened. And that is a fact dispute about what caused the noise, but specifically, what is the policy? How is the policy applied? These are all fact questions. These are analysis the court has gone into in these other cases, like the Anderson case. We don't have that here.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments today. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory time period.